Welcome to episode 198 of the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real, who matters, and how we can make a better world. The Sentientism worldview answers those deep questions by committing to evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I speak with Amelia Leese. Amelia is co-author of the book Think Like a Vegan and host of the Think Like a Vegan podcast. She's involved in the Birchfield Highlands Rewilding Project in Scotland, edits the quarterly magazine for the Heath and Hampstead Society in London, and has developed life skills and ethics workshops for underserved youth. Professionally, she's been a corporate finance lawyer for over 20 years. I'd love to know what you think of this episode of the 197 others in our explorable back catalogue. The best way to let me know is via a review or rating. Your subscriptions, reviews, ratings, and sharing with friends help more people find out about the Sentientism worldview, hopefully nudging the world slowly towards more compassionate, rational thinking. You can find out more about Sentientism at sentientism.info, where you can sign up for email updates, or just search for Sentientism, that's sentient with ism on the end, on your favourite social media platform. You'll be made very welcome in all of our global online communities. They're open to anyone interested in these ideas, not just sentientists. One of our latest community projects is working to get the Sentientism worldview integrated into education curricula. If you'd like to find out more or help make that happen in your country, please get in touch at hello@sentientism.info via one of our groups or just message us online. Thanks for listening.
Animal agriculture has never been nice. It's not nice now that it's industrial, but it's also not nice 10,000 years ago. It was never nice because at the end of the day, at the receiving end, there's always objectification, exploitation, and death. The frequency and all of that, that changes. But to the being is only one anyway. You only have one life. And that bear is starving because we have created this world that operates the way it does. And the loss of biodiversity, the overfishing, and we have done that. So we're responsible for that too. Cows have to give birth to lactate because they are mammals. And I'm like, what? Why did I never think of that? Now I understand. As I thought about, you know, my own privilege of sitting there with a variety of different reproductive choices, I thought, well, I am literally harming another being who has no choices over their reproductive world. How did I miss that overnight? I'm like, yeah, I'm done. I am done.
And you were done with dairy, but did you?
I was done with all of it.
Good morning, Emmy. How are you?
I'm very well, Jamie. It's so nice to be here.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It feels like the next stage because we've been following each other on social media for a long while. I've subscribed to your Substack. I've just finished listening backwards through your Think Like a Vegan podcast, which is awesome.
Oh, that's fantastic. Likewise.
We moved to the next stage when Troy Vitezzi, one of our mutual guests, introduced us via email. So it's great to take the next step and actually have a Zoom conversation. And given you don't live too far away down the Northern Line when you're in London, we might even be able to meet up in real life at one point. So
I look forward to that. I look forward to that. And you know, it's so funny. We're both obviously so involved and connected and so forth, but then you sometimes miss the obvious connection. So when Troy made the introduction, I was like, wait a second, how have I missed you? So now we've been following each other and I've been listening back through your work as well. And it's been terrific. So I'm really glad to be here.
I think given the way the vegan community works, the next stage is probably for us to find something deeply irritating about each other and get in some vicious online flame war. So I look forward to that.
I'm excited. Yeah. Arguing online is something I never do. So I'm so sorry to disappoint you already.
You're a wiser person than me. There's someone wrong on the internet. I must continue to fight. Now, I'm not too bad. I'm trying to get better. So yeah, it's brilliant to talk to you. And like I said, I've been enjoying Think Like a Vegan on the podcast form for quite a while. We share quite a few guests, and not just Troy, but Josh Milburn, Aisha Akhtar. I might steal a few more of yours too if in the future, if you don't mind. But you're a listener to Sentientism too, so you know this already. But I guess this is a series of conversations about what I think of as the deepest and most important philosophical questions, and tragically ones that, even though I think the answers are obvious, most of humanity still gets wrong. And are there questions of epistemology, questions of what's real and how to understand this strange universe we share? But just as importantly, the questions of ethics, what matters and who matters? You know, who should we care about? And how did that play into what we think of as right and wrong, or good and bad, and how we can try and make the world better? And I have an obvious bias because I'm trying to popularize and develop sentientism as this really pluralistic, broad worldview, which in a sentence is evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings. So it suggests a broadly naturalistic approach to trying to work out what's true and what's real, with a healthy dose of humility, hopefully. And on the ethical front, it's pretty open about ethics, as we'll come on to discuss, but it does insist that we should have moral consideration at least for every sentient being, any being that has the capacity to have experiences, to feel things, anything at all. But you know, as you know, I talk in these conversations to a wide variety of fascinating minds, some of whom agree, some of whom don't. So it'd be interesting to understand your own philosophical journey and how that plays into what you do today.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I will stop rambling on and give you a chance. It'd be great if you wouldn't mind just introducing yourself to our audience for those who don't already follow you.
I'd be delighted. So my name is Amelia Leith. I'm the co-author of a book called Think Like a Vegan, and the host of the podcast, which is also called Think Like a Vegan, conveniently. And I have been vegan for over a decade. My sort of professional career has been as a corporate finance lawyer. So you'll get a healthy dosage of economics and finance and all of that stuff in my work, including my vegan work. And I've been involved in a variety of different things, including Avery Wilding Project in the Highlands in Scotland. I'm a magazine editor. And a bunch of other things, and I write a lot in other aspects as well.
That's wonderful. Thank you. Quite an eclectic mix.
It is. I keep very busy.
Do you manage to get sleep occasionally?
Occasionally, yeah.
Well, thank you. Well, let's start with the first of these big philosophical questions, this question of what's real. And this is a super broad topic because it covers everything we might choose to believe, but quite often an interesting way in is to understand my guest's journey with respect to religion and the supernatural or the spiritual, and whether they grew up originally in that sort of culture and household, or one that was maybe more naturalistic, atheistic, agnostic, and how that side of their thinking has changed over their life, if it has. And we can also broaden that out into how do you think about the best ways of understanding the world today?
I think this is it's an interesting question. And so let's start with the easy bits. So I grew up initially in near Naples and in a Catholic family. I went to Catholic school, which I hated. They never made sense to me that only some people would be, and as a little kid, I had it, you know, like would go to heaven just because they were Catholic or, you know, whatever. And that never made sense to me. So unsurprisingly, I let my teachers know that even at like 5 or 6 years old, that really was like, well, this still makes no sense. Why would we do that?
And how did that go down?
They kind of stopped asking me questions. I was like, no, this doesn't make sense.
And was you, and I don't want to stop your flow, sorry, but I'm interested that even at 5 to 6 years old, I find that fascinating because I'm lucky to do quite a lot of work in schools, and I find the 5 or 6 year old mind is often much more incisive than the average adult, particularly on Twitter. So in a way, it's not surprising you're asking those questions, but it takes a certain bravery to do it. But it was interesting that your challenge there seemed to be more about the practicalities and the morality of, you know, separating people between heaven and hell. Or was it more about the sort of the facts and the evidence and the reason of just doesn't seem like it could be real more technically, or a bit of both?
I think probably a bit of both. I mean, it's kind of hard, you know, to me, it just didn't make any logical sense on any of it as a kid. Now, I should preface all this. My dad is an Indian philosophy professor, and he taught at the university in Naples, at the Oriental Studies University, part of the University of Naples. And so Indian philosophy, Hinduism, and a variety of different religions, a variety of different people would always be coming through the house. So I would meet all sorts of people. And you know, I'm relatively well-versed. I've read lots of things, you know, going through my life, read lots of things, studied lots of philosophies and religions and things like that from the Christian tradition and Catholic and through Eastern religions and traditions, Judaism, the lot. I've read it. It's all been very interesting. But I didn't get to a point that I said, none of it matters. It actually doesn't matter. None of it matters. It matters what I do, the here and now. Everything else can sort itself out later. Great. People have their traditions, and I love that. And I love knowing about the traditions, and I love seeing how the traditions and beliefs and religions can shape people's lives and can guide them through difficult periods or through their day to day, whatever that may be. But for me, ultimately, I don't need to have any of that. And I'm okay with that as well, because ultimately, at the end of all of them, the fundamentals of all of them is love. So it doesn't actually matter how you practice that, just practice it, you know, and that love then turns into a respect and a valuing of life, of sentient life, and not necessarily sentient life too. I mean, the respect from sentient life then flows to all everything that's around us, whether that's plants and fungi and even minerals and mountains. We seeing them being carved out, they may not feel anything, but that doesn't matter. That's all part of, you know, it's all part of it. It's all connected. And ultimately, so there's love and there's connection, and we're all connected. We're all in a single vessel hurtling through space. And the fate of the least among us, the smallest among us, the least important, however you want to define that, is extremely important. And it will have an impact on the greatest and the most important, again, however you want to define that. I don't think those things exist. I think everybody is actually, and everyone and everything is on the same plane, is on the same level. But for example, you know, concretely, of bees and insects, how they go, we go. So
we're all in it together.
We're all in it together. The end.
Yeah. So it sounds like you were challenging Catholicism at quite an early age, clearly. You learned about and were fascinated by, you know, almost the full suite of religions. There are so many of them, but the diversity of them. And you can see the value that they hold in terms of community and finding meaning for many people. But the core that runs through them all is that love, ultimately, you know, a sense of compassion and a universal version of that, that you find, coming on to our next question about what matters and who matters, you can hold to without needing any of the religious superstructure or without needing a supernatural being to tell us to do those things. We can just do that. Is that a sort of fair?
I think that's fair. Yeah. I don't need an outside force to tell me to do the right thing, as long as I keep in mind a certain basic fairness. That I think, you know, and that's one of the things that I've done in the book as well. Always go back to basic fairness. Treat everyone the same unless there's a morally relevant reason to treat them differently. And by treatment, I don't mean just on a day-to-day basis, but on the fundamental things, on the fundamental rights, on the fundamental, on things that impinge on our fundamental being, our everyday, our being able to be ourselves and so on and so forth. I think that is the most important thing. And if we go back to that, every time that we have a question, even when it's difficult, you can use that to weave your way through.
Yeah. And we'll come back to this. This is one of the beautiful things about these conversations, because you can't really segregate. I don't think you can really segregate the what's real question from the what matters question. And they flow through each other quite smoothly and quite naturally for many people. But to drag you back to the epistemology for a moment, How would you describe the way you go about trying to work out what's true and what's real in this complicated world? Because while the religious story is one question where you have to apply an epistemology, you know, is there a God? Is there a heaven and a hell? You know, are there spirits? Are there souls? These types of questions. There are so many other questions too. And we see those played out in modern politics and online and everywhere else. But they always have been, right? There are people are struggling to understand the truth and battling over it. And I guess with the sentientism worldview, I'm not suggesting an answer. It doesn't say here's a list of things you have to believe. And it doesn't even believe you can only believe in naturalistic things and you cannot believe in the supernatural. Instead, it's talking about an epistemology rather than an ontology and saying, look, well, at least let's agree on the toolkit. And there it does suggest we should use, you know, evidence and reasoning very broadly construed to try and understand reality. But many people do find other sources of knowledge too. And that might be through faith or through revelation or through, you know, some form of dogma or an authority elsewhere. So how do you think about those types of things now? Are you, I mean, I'm sort of fairly boring straight down the line, naturalistic, but with humility. So I'm, you know, I want to be open-minded to even radically weird ideas, but until the evidence is there, I'm going to hold back my credences and beliefs. Do you leave some space in your epistemology for different potential ways of knowing things that go beyond sort of naturalistic understanding?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, I have personally witnessed things that I cannot explain, and I'm okay with that. There's no way for me to explain certain things, and there's lots of things I don't know. So I've decided that's all fine.
Yeah.
It's fine. You know, it just let them be.
And I'd suggest those are actually quite important parts of a naturalistic worldview, because if you insist on having perfect knowledge of everything, you're bound to make mistakes. To be naturalistic, uncertainty has to be at the center of that. There have to be things that you acknowledge you don't know or you're at least uncertain about, and there may be some things we'll never know, right? I think to be rational and to be naturalistic, you have to acknowledge that. That doesn't mean you're, you know, believing something when there's no evidence to support it, but it does mean you're very open-minded and you're humble about the strength of your current knowledge. But
absolutely, and I mean, you have to leave space for knowledge and learning as you go on, and you have to leave space for changing your mind about things. As we learn more things, we decide to behave in different ways, and that's fine. And that's critical, and that's important. And that's important whether it's from just even from a very practical standpoint. We don't come into the world with all the knowledge. So we learn everything. We learn everything from very practical things like, I don't know, walking to how to do complex math, which I still can't do. And, So it's fine. But even if you take it a step further into practicality, even in activism and in any of that, the more you learn and the more you practice something, you will say, you know what? Maybe what we're asking for needs to be developed. Maybe how we are doing X, Y, Z, that needs to change. So the more we learn, the more we change. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. I guess in some ways, yeah, actually, and I can even say that from the perspective of the Rewilding Project, we had a certain idea, but then the more we learned and the more we realized and stepped back and thought about things, we're like, oh yeah, no, we're not going to do it that way. We're going to do something else. And, you know, that's, if you're not so fixed and you can sort of go along with things a little bit more in a certain flexibility, I think that's better. As long as you have, again, there has to be, but there is the overarching fairness. There is the overarching ethics of, you know, the most basic of ethics, if you will.
Yeah. And we'll come on to the ethics next. But one of the interesting conversations I have, including with many vegans, is why in this sentientism idea, I do include epistemology. What do I talk about that at all? Can't we just focus on the ethics, the rights, the fairness, the compassion, and leave the epistemology separately? And part of the reason I don't is, one, because I think if we want to make the world better, it's useful to understand the world. And the best chance I think we have of understanding the world is by engaging with it honestly, using our senses, using information to try and, like you say, with humility, with openness, with doubt, always open to changing, you know, use that approach. That seems more likely that we'll understand the world better, which helps if we want to make the world better. But it's also because I guess it's an ancient problem, but very modern problem, that I see broken epistemology leading otherwise very compassionate people into extremely dark ethical places. So that can play through with some of the religious challenges you were talking about before, where, you know, there's this message of universal love and compassion, but a belief in a rule that was written in an old religious book, or a belief in the existence of hell, or a belief that there is a deity that is perfectly good but would send people to that hell. These aren't necessarily ethical mistakes. They're actually epistemological mistakes. They're mistakes about reality that then lead people to constrain their universal compassion, or make it conditional, or in some cases just do terrible things. And I guess in the modern situation, you can see situations of misinformation, disinformation, conspiracism, where again, genuinely good people who care about making the world a better place can end up doing terrible things just because they're deeply wrong about the facts. And I guess I was going to ask how you see that playing through in your work around veganism, because there I do see some spaces where people have made an ethical error. They're like, I just don't care about animals, right? That's an ethical choice, which I think is mistaken. You know, I'm excluding them from moral consideration. I'm denying their rights. But it strikes me that as much of the problem is an epistemological one, where people who do care about animals still exploit them or pay for them to be exploited because of factual errors and misunderstandings and misinformation.
Precisely, but it's both. I mean, I don't think that you can extract the two. With respect to animals, it's deciding that they don't fit into your definition of who should be included in the moral community. So that's a cross section of problems there. So because you have to go through the definition. Well, you know, who do we include in our moral community, and why not include everyone who's sentient, a very minimum? And also, just for the record, I totally appreciate and that sentience as a baseline isn't the sole one, like in the work from Manisha Dekha. And she talks about beingness. And I think it's extraordinary. And I think she's onto something really important and as a next step above and beyond that. But going back to sentience and using that as a basis, deciding that you're going to exclude anyone from your moral community because they have some external quality that you yourself possess, but everyone else may not. I mean, that's both definitional and ethical problem. And, you know, how you deal with that is, you know, there has to be better thinking. There has to be better rhetoric. We as advocates have to be better at our own rhetoric. We have to put in a little bit of work and time in studying and reading and thinking things through. Which is one of the things that we try to do with Think Like Vegan, the book, and the podcast as well, is you kind of set out very basic ideas in terms of definitions, and then in terms of concepts, and then how do you apply them to real life? How do you apply them to your day-to-day life, even in difficult situations? Will you always come up with the right answer? Will you not even the right answer? Will you always come up with an answer that satisfies everything? No, because we live in a very imperfect world, or as I like to call it, we live in a capitalist non-vegan world. And so there will be inherent things that you are not going to be able to solve. But, and again, I think there needs to be a lot of questioning, and there needs to be a lot of pushing back and analysis that we can all do. But we can all do it. We don't need to be, you don't need to be well versed in philosophy. You don't need to be well versed in particle physics, you know, or anything complicated. Like, we can all get there if we just step back and maybe look at, you know, what is driving our actions? Is it fear that's driving our actions? Is it a fear of reprisal from a deity? Is it a fear of the other? Is it a fear of change? Is it a fear of admitting that we were wrong? You know, and
fear of social norms. Yeah.
And, you know, simply confronting those things and being comfortable with saying, yeah, okay, I'm afraid. And so.
Yeah. And I think you're right that you don't need a lot of this is really basic stuff. And I hesitate about calling it common sense because it's not necessarily that common, but it is quite straightforward thinking. And it is the sort of thinking that often children are better at than us adults because of the social norm indoctrination. And I think there is a real opportunity to do better. And to your point, we need to do better both on the epistemology and the ethics, because again, you can't separate them. They feed off each other. So some people will, it's very common to work backwards from an implication. You know, I want to act in this certain way, which has this implication for me, you know, which means I need to exclude these beings from my ethical scope. And now to justify that, I need to warp the facts. And it can work the other way around as well, where people can have a warped understanding of facts about whether it's sentience or whether certain types of farming are humane or not, or what standard practices in animal agriculture and exploitation are, that then can lead on to ethical harm. So they feed each other and feed off each other.
Absolutely. I mean, it's also very convenient that we've set it up like that for ourselves. I mean, ultimately, you know, in the Middle Ages, because of political and religious, but tied in with politics and power, we've decided, okay, we're going to build this map of who's at the top and who's at the bottom, and who's in and who's out, who's cool and who's not. And you know, that is very convenient.
We love those hierarchies as long as we're in the right place.
Exactly. As long as you're at the top, all right. You know, as soon as you're not, you then start to realizing, oh yeah, maybe that's not a good idea. But You know, one of the things that I always talk about too, with respect to you talked about animal agriculture. Animal agriculture has never, or animal agribusiness really, has never been nice. It's not nice now that it's industrial, but it's also not nice 10,000 years ago. You know, 5,000 years ago, it doesn't matter. It was never nice because at the end of the day, the niceness matters to who's at the end, who's at the receiving end. So at the receiving end, there's always objectification, exploitation, and death. That doesn't change. The manner, the quantum, the frequency, and all of that changes. But really, and to the being is only one anyway. You only have one life.
Yeah, and that's a perfect link to the second question, which we've already started talking about, which is that question of what matters, the questions of ethics. And to my mind, what you've just done there is absolutely central to almost any conception of ethics, is trying to take the perspective of the other.
Absolutely.
And again, there's all sorts of different philosophies that will take a different approach. There's nihilism, or there's a relativism, which says it's really just a sort of negotiated set of rules a group might come up with. There's divine command theory, where it's ultimately about obedience to a deity, right? But if we put those types of morality to aside, and I would, because I don't think they even really count as moralities in a sense. They're almost amoralities. Most conceptions of morality are about trying to take the perspective of the other, as you've just done there, right? That's how we should think about these things.
Yeah, exactly. But even, you know, when you're looking at a fixed system, then you're looking at who the other that you even owe anything to is.
Yeah, you've got to realize there's an other there in the first place, right?
You have to realize there's an other, and you know, how you're going to treat the other, and whether you have to treat the other as you would treat, quote, the others in your own community. I mean, I think that is critical. And I don't know. I can't talk about how things might have been for somebody that was living in, you know, the 1400s and how they had to deal with things. But, you know, we're here today, and whatever happened then doesn't necessarily mean that you have to do the exact same things now. So I want to tell you this anecdote because I think it's relevant. So about two years ago, I went to the Himalayan Vegan Festival in Nepal, and I was invited to participate and to give some talks and so on. And One of the things that we did, we went to as a group, all the delegates and so forth. Part of the festival took place in Lumbini, which is the birthplace of Buddha. And there we were at there's a number of temples there and a number of schools and religious schools and so forth. And in one of them, we had this great talk by this fantastic monk. And he was explaining, you know, people ask me all the time, well, but Buddha ate meat, or Buddha said, not Buddha ate meat, but Buddha said to the disciple, but you can eat this, you can eat meat and so forth. So, you know, people use that as an excuse to do so now. And he said, Buddha said that to that disciple at that point in time for those particular instances, that we then take it to today, you, in 2022, I think it was, it doesn't work. So you have to be able to move forward and apply the teachings, not just to whatever is convenient to you, basically, he was saying, but to what are the facts and realities on the ground now? What is in front of you now? You know? And so going back to something else that we said earlier, you know, you need that little bit of flexibility in your thinking to even apply whatever rules, regulation, lessons, and so forth that you have from a fixed system into whatever's happening today. So you have to be able to do that because things have changed. Or we've, you know, you can look at the world a bit differently.
Yeah, I mean, dogma is dangerous in the fields of epistemology and knowledge, and it's dangerous in ethics as well, right? We have to keep that freshness of thinking and that open-mindedness all the time. So part of this what matters question, you've touched on already, because you've talked about fairness, you've mentioned rights, you've also talked about this sort of shifting in perspective and imagining what it's like from the other. How do you think about the, again, you can, if you like, you can tell the story of how you got here, or you can just explain how you think about it now. What's the actual root of morality for you? If there is such a thing, what's right at the bottom? You know, what are good and bad and right and wrong even mean for you? Because there are certain perspectives which, if you like, focus more on us as agents, and they might think about use and exploitation and oppression and our virtues as moral beings. There's a bunch of different ways, approaches, which are more about the moral patients and thinking about their experiences, their interests, their desires, their suffering. There are ideas about, you know, rights, for example, that may link the two and say, look, this moral patient has a right, which gives it an obligation on us as a moral patient. So, but there's so much to cover. There's feminist care ethics, there's deontology, there's, or you can push that all to one side and give you a more common sense view. But how have you come to think about the absolute root of morality?
Yeah, no, exactly. There's so much written, and scholars have been working on these ideas and developing them forever. And there's lots of different things. But again, I think, and I would encourage people to look into it and to read lots and lots of different things so that they then can synthesize them to whatever makes sense to them. Or just simply, you know, for me, a right is something that's inherent. You have that by virtue of being alive and being a sentient individual. And again, beingness goes into it as well. And I think, you know, you have to, if the rights that everybody else has, if you don't have them, you've got to figure out, well, why, you know, what is it that makes, what isn't, is there anything that makes a morally relevant difference?
And is having those rights driven directly from the fact you have interests as a...
Yeah, you have to have the interests. You have to have the interest. You have the interest. You're a subject of life, like Regan says. Because you exist. I think that simply is you're here, and that makes a difference.
So by virtue of having those interests or having that perspective, by definition, that matters to you as an individual. That's almost what those things mean. And a right is, in a way, just saying, and they should matter to everyone else too.
And they should matter to everyone else as well. And I think our presence, our existence in time and space at the same time as other people and as other beings and as other, conditions of living. And I mean, you know, we're all here now and we should all have the same rights to exist on a fundamental level as everybody else. Because if you start going into, well, you know, no, because you have a different belief in gender, because you are a different sex, or because, I mean, those are all external. Those are all external things that aren't morally relevant to the question of whether you can live unfettered, just like others in your community.
Yeah. So rights are central for you, and those rights are driven by the interests and the perspectives and the values that an individual being has in its own right. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, thank you. And does that also mean, because you're talking about, I've heard you talk before about trying to consider all beings as morally equal, and you said there about, you know, we all should have the same right to be able to continue to exist. But because different beings and different types of beings can have radically different interests and perspectives, we might be, you know, we might want different things, we might feel different things. Does that mean different rights can be relevant to different beings and different types of beings? Or do you try and apply the same set of rights to every being, you know, whether or not they're practically relevant?
There's a variety of different rights, but in terms of fundamental rights, the fundamental right of being free from exploitation, number one, because if you don't have that, you can't get any of the other ones. You know, being free to live, love, work, associate, travel, exist unfettered in the most basic of way. I think that's a fundamental. Everything else builds on top of that. And then you can have things, you know, the right to vote. I mean, we made that up. We created that. I mean, we don't need that to live and exist. I mean, yes, we do, because we have created a society that societies work in X, Y, Z way and so forth. But you've got to, you know, sort of peel back and start from the fundamental. And you have to start from, you know, you start from the fundamentals of do we get to exist, even as a basic, so that then we can engage in whatever society we are in.
Yeah, makes sense. So it's almost like there's like the more foundational, fundamental stuff, and then we can layer onto that if we want to.
And then you layer onto that as you progress, and as things change, as realities change, and so forth. But I mean, you do it is a building block in terms of complexity, obviously. But if you don't have the fundamentals, you can't even get to the complexities.
Yeah. And what one of the other tensions, sometimes it's not a tension, but sometimes it is between freedom and autonomy, rights to freedom and autonomy, versus rights to not to suffer or to have a good life, if that makes sense. And quite often they go together, because part of the reason I value my freedom and autonomy is because I enjoy being free and having autonomy, and I don't like being constrained or oppressed. So quite often they link together, but there can be areas where those things can, you know, come apart or strain a little bit. Do you see freedom and autonomy as things that are good because of the impact they have on the quality of experiences of beings? Or do you think they're independently and foundationally important? Or do you think they're even more important than the quality of experiences of being? So you know, if there is a being that is totally free and is not being oppressed, is not being exploited, but is suffering, versus a being that is, you know, feels like it's having a good life and have its needs met, but is actually constrained and doesn't have total autonomy. I don't know if that even makes sense.
Let me take it back to animals, right? So we can use it like that, and then we can go from there. All animals are considered objects, full stop, all over the world. Makes absolutely no difference. And that's codified in laws. We have decided that that's how it's going to be. You're a wild animal, you're owned by the state. you're another type of animal, and it's going to be either the state that owns you, it's going to be or a private individual or a corporation, a business entity of some sort. So a legal entity that's not an actual natural person. You're owned. You're an object, like my phone, like the mic, like the books.
Yeah, an object and a commodity. Yeah,
exactly. You have zero rights. Literally, you have zero rights. So when people are talking about animal rights, and they connect that with how the animal is treated, they're not talking about animal rights, because the right has already gone, because you've skipped right over the question as to whether you're entitled to use the animal, full stop. And so when you're saying like, oh, well, how are we going to treat them? Well, treatment isn't their right. Treatment is more something of how we shape how we are going to feel about how we treat animals, or how we want to see something or not see something, or how we want to catch diseases or not catch diseases, and what we're going to do to hem those things in and to shape those things. So when we're talking about animal rights, we don't often enough stress that without they actually having a right to existence, to their existence, not a comfortable one, not a perfectly ideal one, but to an actual existence where they are not objects, they cannot have anything else.
That's the foundation.
If your existence is always vis-a-vis the other or the owner, you cannot have an existence, because the owner is always going to determine your existence. They're going to treat you nicely now, but then that nice owner dies, and somebody else takes you on and does bad things to you. So you know your right to not suffer is secondary, in the sense that without the actual right to not be an object, which would then lead to inherently not being exploited, or would lead to additional questions on, well, how, why, and are we going to exploit or objectify, and whether, you know, you have to have that. You have to have the actual freedom and the actual autonomy to not be an object, to be free and in the world.
Thank you. That's really helpful, because that's one of the, I think there are people who will focus on, you know, the experience of a sentient being in good faith, and philosophically that's an important thing for them, and it is for me. But there are other people who will, wittingly or not, use that focus on the experience of a sentient being to skip over the fundamental you're talking about, and to say, well, as long as we treat these beings well, as long as we think they're having a good life, of course they're not, as long as we think they have a good life, it's okay for us to constrain their autonomy and exploit them in certain ways. So it can be done in a bad faith way too.
You know, it's just how we've decided. And I think as activists, we need to challenge that a lot more. I mean, you know, I...
Go back to that foundation.
We have to go back to that foundation, because if we don't, then we'll just keep doing the exact same thing and keep fighting about treatment, when we're really, really should be fighting about use, because that's the fundamental, you know. And I have a couple of analogies about this in Think Like a Vegan, and actually in the next season of my own podcast, I will be talking about this. But like, think about it from a very practical human point, so you go swimming in a river that's polluted, you get sick, you go to the doctor. A doctor fixes you, you get antibiotics, whatever, and you're fine. Great. Going to the doctor, getting the medicine, treatment, is important, really critical, because obviously you're suffering. You don't want to be suffering. No need to. Then you go swimming in the river again. The river's still polluted. You go swimming again. You get sick again. And then you go back to the doctor, and on and on and on. If you don't fix the pollution, you're continuously going to get ill.
It's the root cause. It's the foundation and the...
Well, exactly. So, and it's very easy for people to say, oh, we have to treat them well. Okay. That's nice. Yeah. Yes, we do. Obviously, it's horrific. It's all horrific. It is a continuous mass scale of horrors that we live with and are perfectly fine with. And by we, I mean, you know, the entire planet.
Yeah, society at large, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And okay, but if we don't actually say, well, are we entitled to do that? Why? Why are we entitled to do that? And because we said so 10,000 years ago, because there is this, you know, because we've decided so. Well, I mean, that's at the root of speciesism. That's at the root of any variety of things that you know, you've decided someone else doesn't get your rights because you've got more power over them.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Thank you. That's really helpful. Now, so it's clear that's a foundational problem for you, that question of use and exploitation and just the ability not to be objectified, to be recognized as a being in your own right, with your own will to live and your own will to be free and to do what you want to do. And that's the foundation that we need to double down on and reinforce and not get lost in the higher levels. But at the same time, you do recognize those higher levels matter too, because I also worry there's a risk of going too far the other way, where if all we focus on is use and exploitation and objectification, that can lead us to morally disregard the suffering of beings that aren't being constrained or aren't being exploited. And it's a difficult topic, but you can get into, you know, thinking
like
about
what? Like which beings are
liminal animals or animals living in free ranging in the wild.
Oh, so, well, I mean, in terms of suffering that they would be sort of in their own spheres, or suffering that we have created because of the way we have.
Well, if we've created it, I think it's very clear that there's still some form of objectification or exploitation going on. But if where there are animals that are completely free ranging, where there's arguably no impact of humans at all.
And I disagree. I'll stop you. I'm going to interrupt you because otherwise I'll
forget.
Well,
this is why I was asking. I was interested in, yeah.
I'm gonna interrupt you because I think, for example, I think I wrote something about this some time ago when I went on one of my tirades about documentaries. You know what? Let's go to you know, a charismatic animal like the polar bears. And polar bears, some time ago, there was a polar bear suffering. There was that picture of a very thin polar bear. They were starving because they couldn't get the seals and the food that they needed, and so on and so forth. They're free. They are suffering. They're free, relatively speaking. Let's just take aside the idea that they are an object in the laws of whatever country that polar bear is traveling through. Let's keep that aside. They're free. They're suffering. And documentary filmmakers would say, oh, yeah, well, isn't that sad? No, you know who's responsible for that? We are, collectively, all of us. Because that bear is starving because we have created this world that operates the way it does, that has rendered it, has brought upon these conditions and the loss of biodiversity, the warming of the seas and the overfishing and the blah, the blah, the blah. We have done that. So we're responsible for that too. So we're responsible, full stop. You know, and so that for me, in a very specific niche sort of way, but, you know, when you have the documentary filmmaker that's like, oh, isn't that sad? Yeah, no, what do you, no, like, you wouldn't be saying that. You wouldn't be just saying, oh, isn't that sad? Let's go on to the next frame if it were a human suffering. But let's then say, I'll talk about something that happened out here. There were birds feeding on the ground. And all of a sudden, I was sitting out there with one of my cats. And all of a sudden, I hear a very distinct sound I had never heard before. And there's kind of a thump, but it's much more subtle. And both my cat and I see it. He jumps back. He's never seen anything like this before. And I was like, a bird of prey, I forget which type of hawk or falcon, came in and picked up this pigeon and took him away for to eat. That bird happened to be in my garden, and the other bird also happened to be in my garden, and I witnessed it. Did I have control over that? Did I instigate that? You know, no. I'm not responsible for that suffering. Can I feel bad about it as a person? Yeah, sure. Can I say, oh, that bird shouldn't have done that? No, I have zero right to do that. I can feel bad about it, and I can also say that's just how it is. I can't do the same thing with respect to the polar bear, because even though I personally didn't do it, collectively, with every other human on Earth before me and after me, we are responsible for that. We are responsible for that suffering.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's fair to say that I don't think there is any wild animal that is untouched by humans just because of our impact on the climate. I mean, yeah, you can go
exactly
to the most remote place you like, but you do. I mean, at the same time, humans aren't responsible for all the suffering there is in the wild.
No.
Your approach to that suffering, if I can paraphrase it, is to recognize that it's morally salient. It matters. You can still empathize with the being there, just as you would empathize with a human who's been in a natural disaster that wasn't human caused, right? You wouldn't apportion blame. You wouldn't morally criticize the hawk as you wouldn't morally criticize an earthquake, right? But you can still empathize with those beings. And I guess it's then an open question of whether or not you might choose to help, because it's not your you didn't cause the harm. It's not your responsibility in that sense. But does it still leave the door open to help and support and assist in some way? In the same way as, you know, the local community here, while most of them will consume sentient beings unthinkingly three times a day, there'll be an outpouring of emotion if a duck at the local pond gets an injured leg or, you know, falls sick, right? In a weird way, average humans are more willing to extend empathy to, you know, liminal and selected charismatic wild animals than they are to farmed animals. But
yes, or to whatever is convenient to them at the time. I mean, the empathy is there. We all have the raw materials inside us to feel, and that's there. And it's just we selectively apply it wherever we want. I mean, and you know, the whole idea, and you spoke with Josh Milburn in his book, Feeding Animals, you know, that the whole question, I think, is an important one to think about in terms of, you know, wild animal suffering. But for me, you know, I look at, well, what am I responsible for? And in Josh's work, you know, that responsibility shifts, and you can become responsible for certain things. And I think, you know, you have to, when you're dealing with the wild, I think you have to decide. I think that there are some uncomfortable decisions that you have to make, or uncomfortable compromises that you have to come to.
And mind-blowing complexity to deal with as well, right? This, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, from a very basic saying, well, you know, if you set up a feeding station for certain animals but not others, you know, what kind of environment are you creating there? Are you creating something where a predator can come in and so on? Or are you feeding predators themselves? And then what are you feeding them? I mean, and then you come into the whole, you know, what are you feeding your pet, you know, companion animals and pets, however you want to define it, you know, and those are complex things. But, you know, going back to something we said earlier, we live in a capitalist non-vegan world, and we have to make some really uncomfortable compromises sometimes, which I think we need to think about. I don't think we need to shy away from, you know, you can't just dismiss them. It's fine to say, I disagree, but I disagree why, or I can do X about this, or I can do Y about this, and I've thought about it. I think we owe it to ourselves and to others to think about these things.
Yeah, they need interrogation, yeah. Now, before we move off the ethical question, I wanted to ask you about your own journey when we're thinking about moral scope and who gets to count, because it's interesting, quite a lot of our conversation about rights and fairness and justice and objectification, you know, most humans would probably, if we were only talking about humans, they would be like, you know, sign me up, absolutely, I agree. But this question of moral scope is deeply important, because once you're excluded, like you say, you're an object, right? Anything could be done to you with impunity, pretty much. So what was your journey thinking about moral scope, and how did you come into this? Yeah, I guess partly, how did you start out thinking about family, friends, other humans, and sort of intrahuman justice? But how did you come to the animal question too? What was that journey like?
The human stuff is easy. That was self-evident, really. So just applying the same sort of ideas that you'd want to apply to for yourself and so on. You'd learn about different things. With respect to animals, how it started for me was through dairy and understanding how dairy is produced. That did it for me.
And how did you come across that in the first place?
I think...
I did my best to avoid that topic for a long while. I mean, I was vegetarian from my mid-20s, and I probably spent most of the next 15 years trying not to think about dairy.
No, I just never had never occurred to me. And I saw a poster, and I think it was from Gary Francione, actually, whose his work and his early work is fantastic and brilliant, and I recommend it. I think it was a poster like, dairy takes babies away from their mothers or something like that. And I was like, what? I mean, and I was in my 40s. And I was like, what? How did I, what? And so I was thinking of, I saw it and I just saw it. That was it. And just, you know. And then I was sitting in a doctor's office. This was, again, over 10 years ago now. I was sitting in a doctor's office for IVF. And I was thinking, and I was like, and something had popped in my head, and I was like, wait, so I'm sitting here, dairy, of course, cows have to give birth to lactate because they are mammals. Literally, it's in the name. And I'm like, what? Why did I never think of that? Now I understand. And so, you know, as I thought about, you know, my own privilege of sitting there with a variety of different reproductive choices, I thought, well, here I am exercising my privilege, but yet I am literally harming another being who has no choices over their reproductive world. And then I'm harming them. This is appalling. How did I miss that? And so that was pretty much that. Overnight, I'm like, yeah, I'm done. I am done.
And you were done with dairy, but did you?
No, I was done with all of it.
You ran that through everything, yeah.
Yeah, I was done with all of it.
And what did that feel like psychologically? And what was it like socially with friends and family and those around you? Because as you say, we live in this, you know, capitalistic, very non-vegan world. Or did you just push through it and sort everybody else?
I mean, you know, I talk about this a little bit in my book with respect to my husband. And I mean, you know, like we had loads of different arguments. And he was vegetarian, but he would eat fish. When we first started dating, I was like, if you eat fish, they're not vegetables. That doesn't work. But again, poor guy, he didn't know that this is how I am, you know. But the nuns at 5 years old, they could have told him. But dairy and cheese, you know, it's one of the pleasures in life. I'm like, yeah, totally get the pleasure, but that doesn't mean that we need to harm someone else for our own pleasure. That, you know, unless it's consensual, totally different. That's just not going to work. And eventually, you know, he came around and, you know, he's been vegan. I don't know exactly at what point, because I sort of found out by accident, because we would have these discussions. And then, you know, that's it. I mean, the food I made at home was all vegan and everything like that. And then, you know, he adopted that in his life outside the home, and he's been vegan for a long time as well. And with respect to friends and family, well, you know, you just sort of let them know. And some of them are like, okay. And some of them, you know, especially in the beginning, would ask the classic questions and the classic tropes. You learn to navigate that. And then people are fine. For the most part, people are fine. You still get aggro from some people. But, you know, ultimately, the aggro that I get from people is nothing in comparison. I mean, for me to say, oh, I don't want to get aggro from the person, and so therefore I'm going to take someone else's life for that. Absolutely not. Like, that to me, that's a driver. That's my driver. I don't care. You're upset that I'm vegan. That's your problem. You know, I'm not going to hurt another being just to make you feel comfortable. I literally wouldn't do that with respect to a human. I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't make you feel comfortable if you know someone was making sexist comments and I found that appalling. I wouldn't say, haha, oh yeah, that's so funny. No, I wouldn't, because that's at the expense of real people.
Yeah, you're coming back to the perspective of the beings of the people harmed by those things, right? Yeah, that's the core.
If we center everything on ourselves, that doesn't work. If the center is always like, well, you know, it's about me when it's not about you. It's different if it is about you. If it is about, you know, a problem, an issue that you're having, a different story. But when we're talking about much bigger issues, we have to look at who is actually affected, put them in the center, and then from there, consider everything else. I mean, I use the image of a wheel with spokes. At the center, you put whoever's affected. So, you know, is it animals? You put them in the center. Is that the question? What is best about animals? You put them in the center, and then you make the considerations in the spokes from there. Is it feminism? Then you put that in the center, and then you move from there. Whatever the issue is, you have to look at it from that perspective. Otherwise, you're centering yourself and taking the space of the victim or the subject of the issue. And that doesn't work, because that only works for you, you know?
Yeah, that's the foundation. Yeah, yeah. Well, in the time we've got left, I guess the final big question, it's just as crazily broad, is how can we make a better world? And I'd love, you know, your thoughts on that. You can go, you know, broader and bigger picture as well, if you like, about how we can make a better world. But in a sense, that's part of the point of your book, Think Like a Vegan, because there's an implied hope there that ultimately everybody will. So what do you think the world would look like if everybody thought like a vegan? What would that mean?
It means we would have thought about a lot of other things as
yeah.
Well.
Yeah.
You know, you know, my usual answer, if the world went vegan overnight. Yeah. Okay. If the world went vegan overnight, that means we would have addressed so many other questions before that we wouldn't have all the answers. There would be debate, there would be discussions, and it would actually be, we would have sorted out a whole lot of our problems with respect to animals, with respect to each other, and with respect to nature and so forth. We would actually be having real conversations. I mean, obviously, you want a better world. The least you can do is be vegan. That's a basic thing. Nobody's a hero for being vegan, but you're also a hero for being vegan. Those are two things that exist at the same time.
And it's interesting you say that's the basics, because I agree it's a foundational thing. The popular view of veganism is that it's extreme and it's highly demanding, but I don't think it's demanding at all. You know, the practical aspect of veganism is just doing what we can to end exploitation and use of others. It doesn't even ask us to help or to make any sacrifices or to harm ourselves. It's minimally demanding, right? It's about the most basic demand you could have once you've acknowledged the moral consideration of someone else.
It's saying to somebody, well, you know, why don't you not be sexist? You know, don't be sexist. Don't be racist. Don't be ableist. Don't be homophobic. I mean, these are basics. And, you know, if somebody, that person's not sexist, great. Thank you. You shouldn't be. Like, the end.
What, do you want a medal?
Right, exactly. So that's why I say, like, you're not a hero for being vegan. It's just a basic It's just a literal basic. That's it. It's a foundation. Everything else on top of that, fantastic. If you want to do more, fantastic. So, but the thing is, it does change everything. It changes your perspectives on so many things. It brings everything in line. If you've already understand issues of justice and fairness in terms of humans and in terms of the environment and so forth, and being vegan just ties it all together anyway. And so you then actually become more reinforced in what you already see as being the right thing to do and the good thing to do for everyone and everything around you. So there's that. And you'll find opportunities to, whether you want to be an advocate in whatever way you want to be an advocate, you don't have to do protests, you don't have to, anything. And just sometimes existing as a vegan is enough activism. So activism is a very, very broad term. And so in whatever space you can be to make it better for people, for animals, for the environment, whatever it is, I think you can do it. And I mean, other things that we can do is, it's to just think critically of the various stuff that we see, the news that we see, the things that we read, and to just, ask, well, who is this benefiting? Who's getting or follow the money? Who's making the most money out of this? And to look at it, look at things a little bit more like that, not cynically, and not to say, blah, 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 and then just gloss everything over, but to really push that. Like, well, who's benefiting from this and how? I think, using that is, and it's really not even, it's not that hard. It just requires a little bit of scrutiny.
Yeah. So that back to that epistemology question of, like you say, not cynically disregarding everything, but just a sensible level of criticism and understanding the perspective of where those messages are coming from and why, and using that to inform yourself. Yeah.
Exactly. And, how you get to a better world, it takes time. It's a slog. Things do not change quickly. Whether, the next comment is, oh, but we don't have any time. Well, we may or may not, but it is what it is. There's no such thing as profound change that happens quickly. There's no such thing. Look back in history. No such thing. Especially when it comes to animals. We've been doing this for 10,000 years. That's when we started farming. That is when really our entire relationship, our meaning humans, our entire relationship with the natural world. We're part of the natural world. So our relationship with ourselves and with the rest of the natural world really changed. So if we think that we're going to come in, our little tiny speck of a life, and that things are going to change suddenly, that's absurd. And it's just not how that works. Things take a long time, and you just got to keep doing it. If change is what you are interested in, you just have to do it day in, day out. That's it. Not get discouraged if the moment, if that change doesn't realize itself immediately in your lifetime. But every time that you have a conversation with someone and you show them a different reality, that's incredible change, because that's the kind of change that we want is so profound and so different and so radically different from the current reality, from the current reality of 10,000 years, mind you. And the only way to do it is to really focus on showing how we can exist differently.
Yeah, I like that approach. Everyone's an activist, but there's so many different forms, but you need that persistence, because it's a big complex world. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. In whatever way you want to do it.
You've touched on this already, but again, in a way, we're just sort of evolved apes staggering around, right? So when we think about the totality of all the world's problems, it's mind-blowing. Like, we can't really properly conceive of it or even work out how to navigate it somehow, which isn't an excuse for not doing anything, but it's understandable that stuff is difficult to get our heads around. There's environmental stuff, there's intra-human challenges, there's our exploitation of non-human species. The list goes on. Natural disasters, humanitarian crises, security, war, discrimination, you know, the list goes on. And within veganism, there's all sorts of fascinating, fiery debates, right? But there are some who really want to laser focus veganism explicitly on the human exploitation of non-human animals and nothing else, because they're worried, rightly, that the focus on that as a catastrophically horrific issue will get lost given all of the other stuff going on. So they're like, veganism should just be about the non-human animals and human exploitation of them, and that's it. I think there's also a small group of those people who maybe want to focus veganism on the non-human animal topic to leave them some space for maybe some discriminatory attitudes towards other humans. So they want to compartmentalize the animal issue because they don't really want to apply ideas of justice and fairness and consistent anti-oppression to other human sentient beings. So that's an issue. There are others who will say veganism is inherently engaged in all of those intra-human issues as well, either because humans are animals too, or because thematically these ideas of justice and fairness and exploitation run through intra-human relations as well. So, you know, there's a massive diverse range of views about what veganism is, what it should be, what the definition should be, and how it should play through those issues. How do you think about, you know, the animal issues or the non-human animal issues, the intra-human issues, and how they intersect or touch on each other, and how we should approach that?
The thing is, we have words for all of these things. And what we need to look at is to just focus a little bit out and to look at the shared sources of oppression. They're always the same. It's always the same thing. Oppression is always the same. It's always the objectification of someone else or the othering of someone else, whether that whether it's a person or whether it's an animal and so forth. So you always have that. I think what I have seen is a lot of times people get very muddled in their thinking when they are using an over expansive definition of veganism when there's actually other definitions that we have plenty of words. You know, if you want to talk about labor and worker exploitation, those are two distinct terms you can use. And then you have veganism. Veganism is about animals. That then there are entanglements with everything else. Yes, absolutely, because we do not live in compartmentalized bubbles. And for me, sometimes this kind of either dismissing one or saying, but this and this, no, they all exist at the same time. And yeah, like naturally they exist at the same time because we live in an entangled world. We live in a web of a variety of things. And when you're talking, and it's not even that difficult to do. If you're talking about animal issues and you want to talk about labor issues, let's go. You know, like in a nanosecond, you can talk about that. And you can talk about those two things in the same phrase. You want to write a paragraph about that? Done. And done. Easy. You want to talk about, and then you want to talk about from labor exploitation, you want to talk about racism and sexism, again, boom, linear. Like you can just go one after the other. And we have words for all these things. So focusing on, you know, veganism needs to be more expansive. Well, then I would say labor should be a lot more expansive, which it absolutely should, because obviously most of the labor is completely exploited and oppressed because it's non-human. They're at once, you know, the producers and the product. So even from a Marxist perspective, you can go nuts on this. But anyway, so again, we need to be comfortable with all of these terms and use them all. And if we use one to exclude the others, then we have a different agenda. And then we need to look at, well, what are you trying to push? What are you trying to say? And you know, because you can have all these discussions with words we already have. I'm absolutely happy it's for people to make up new words and for definitions to be expanded and all of that. I'm not saying that everything needs to rigidly be exactly as it is today. I'm not saying that. But I'm also saying well, if there is just this one box and this is the only box you're going to focus on, you're missing a lot of stuff that's going on around you. What, however you want to do it, whether even you're just, if you're just focusing on people, if you're just focusing on people, you should be focusing on animals because there's a lot of stuff that goes on in that. Even if you say, I don't want to talk about veganism. Okay, no. Fine. Talk about people and let's go from there.
I love that approach. I guess one, you're saying, look, there are so many different world problems, but if you try and put each of those problems in its own rigid, completely separate box, you haven't got a chance. But two, to this, to your point you just made there, even if you want to focus on one particular question, people want to prioritize and that's fine, right? Even if you want to focus on your own particular problem, if you put that in a rigid box that never changes and is unconnected to all of the other problems, you haven't got a chance either, right? Because you've failed to understand even that narrow problem, right? So
that's
a great balance.
And I'm always very suspicious when somebody just wants to focus on one thing at the exclusion of everything else. I'm always very suspicious because who is that benefiting? That's benefiting that person or that system of ideas. And generally capitalism does that, compartmentalizes everything so that it's easier to not look at the whole thing. And it's easier. I think we might have a cat incoming.
We have a guest.
Yes, we may have a cat incoming.
An extra guest.
So if we have that, hold on a second. Let me get him. Otherwise, I can't hear and see.
Who's this?
This is Marmy. Hi.
Hello, Marmy.
Hi, Marmy.
Awesome name.
Compartmentalizing is very easy. Divide and conquer, that old adage and that sort of thing. If we don't see how we're all connected and we don't extend our solidarity across all groups and all people and all animals and all conditions, we are always looking, oh, it's your fault. Instead of saying, oh, wait a second, the fault is up here. The fault is not with the guy next door or that problem there. It's that. You know, and I think, and that's a very scary concept in a couple of ways. You know, you can get people who are like, oh, well, then that's an even bigger problem. But you have to look at things in a much more connected way. Otherwise, it's a very lonely existence.
Yeah, that's another point. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Thank you. So you talked about capitalism a few times, but we haven't really sort of drilled into, you know, the implications of it or your view. Now, one of the irritating things about this sentientism worldview is I frame it as being very pluralistic and open. It just says use evidence and reason and have, you know, compassion and moral consideration for all sentient beings. But it doesn't insist on anything specifically beyond that. And that includes, you know, modes of political or economic organization. So there are people, online groups and so on, are, you know, quite politically diverse. They're not politically diverse in the sort of social cultural sphere so much because they are universally committed to, you know, an end to discrimination and universal compassion and so on. So that would exclude some of the some aspects of the social political right for obvious reasons. But when it comes to economic and political modes, there's reasonable diversity there. So there are sentientists who are anarchists, who are communists, who are social democrats, who are socialists, who are reasonably neoliberal, are in favor of some form of compassionate capitalism. You know, it sort of covers quite a broad range of views. So you've talked about capitalism and implied it's, you know, part of the problem. Do you think there is a path for a more compassionate form of capitalism where if the value set of humanity shifted such that shareholders and managers and capitalists and workers and consumers and regulators and so on all had a more compassionate worldview, that we could still harness some of the power of capitalism but get to a good place? Or do you think that capitalism is so inherently exploitative we need something else? And what's your simple view of what that something else might be? That's so unfair to ask in a few minutes.
Look, capitalism, it has gotten us where it's gotten us. And clearly that is not good. Compassion is very nice. No one owes me compassion. I'm owed my rights. You can be nice to me. You can be not nice to me. You can be compassionate. You can hate my guts. I don't care. Give me my rights. And capitalism isn't going to do that. Full stop. If we're looking, you know, shareholder value does not work with people's well-being. It just doesn't.
And you've worked in that space, yeah.
If you're maximizing shareholder value, who's paying for that, literally and figuratively? Someone else is. You know, I mean, we have billionaires. They literally could solve all the problems of the earth right now. We could be done. We could be done. Are they doing that? Absolutely not. So, you know, do we want a system that continues to make that exist? How's that going to work? It's clearly not working. It's not working for 99.9% of the planet. It's working for those folks somehow, but we are all propping that up. So I don't think it works. What we could have instead, you know, I don't know what that is. It's some sort of socialism. I don't know what that would look like exactly, but it's not this. But having said all that, let's just go back to animals. Animals have been used since even before capitalism was even invented. So it's not like we're going to have a socialist society and animals are going to be all right. That doesn't work that way either.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Because they have, again, we got to remember 10,000 years. I hate to be boring about this, but that really is how long we've been doing this. And I've cat fur flying everywhere. Sorry. and because he's right here in front of me. Ultimately, if we think that another political system is going to change our relationship with animals automatically, no, there's no such thing.
It's like a deeper level, right? It's those values, that acknowledgement of rights.
Yes,
it's...
exactly. And I think that's where Manisha Dekha's work really comes into play, where she's questioning how we are defining society at all and who gets a say in it and so forth. So it's, you know, and she conceptualizes it as beingness. So different entities have different levels of being, and how we then relate to one another in that is not as resources, not as objects. That I think is really valuable.
But as fellow beings, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it gives a space also for trees and mountains and rivers and et cetera, et cetera. So everything is valued in a very different way. We just don't have that. We simply don't have that. These are, you know, what I really like about, you know, like Troy's work, Troy Vitteza, who we spoke about earlier, and Manisha Dekha and many other people, is that they are imagining a different world. And I think we really need that too. So the imagination is, we have to imagine a different world in order to create that different world.
Yeah.
If we keep imagining things exactly as they are now, we're not creating anything new. How that would look like, you know, how it would be, I don't know. But what I would hope, what I would like is, you know, the valuing of everything that surrounds us, not just money.
Yeah. Thank you. Now, that's a great answer. And it also twins with what you were saying earlier on, right? In that criticism isn't enough either. Criticism is deeply important, but you need imagination. You need it, you know, the imagination to drive, you know, whatever else too. So that's an inspiring note maybe to finish up on, and I should let you go. Is there anything else you wanted to add into the conversation? But also, how can people follow you, support your work, but including your rewilding project, if you wanted to mention that briefly?
Everybody can find all of the information, all the links and everything like that on my website, emilialese.com, and that's L-E-E-S-E. And you can find me on social media, emilialese. The Rewilding Project, there's links on the website, but it's called Birchfield Forest Rewilding, and that's online as well. You can find Think Like a Vegan anywhere you buy books, or if you don't want to buy a book and you want to get it from the library, ask your library to carry it, although the book is in 61 nations worldwide. It's in hundreds of libraries already in the UK, in the US, all over Europe, and it's even in Botswana. I have no idea, but it's in a library in Botswana. It's extremely amazing. And listen to the podcast if you like, and that way you can get in touch with me as well.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, it's been great to get the chance to talk to you live. Hopefully we'll get a chance to meet in person somewhere in North London at some point. And thank you so much for being a guest on Sentientism. It's been an inspirational conversation.
Likewise, it's been brilliant. Thank you so much for having me, and I look forward to meeting up in real life.
Yeah, please stay in touch. Cheers, Emmy.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?